is because I carry notes. Now, those of you who are new to the conference, I don't know if you've noticed that Henry Johnson is from the South. And he has very few one-syllable words, even though they're spelled with one syllable. But just to tell you how Southern he really is, I heard something about something that happened in his hometown the other day. There was a young boy walking down the street, and this huge dog foaming at the mouth and barking came leaping out of the bushes and went to jump on this little boy. And there was a man that was walking nearby, and he saw what was happening, and he ran over, and he grabbed the dog, and he wrestled it to the ground. And they rolled over and over in the street, and he strangled the dog, and finally he killed it before it could harm the little boy. And there was another man that was driving by, and he saw it all happen. He stopped the car, and he got out, and he went over to the man. He said, "I'm the editor of the Western Carolina Register, and I saw what you just did, and I can see tomorrow's headline, Western North Carolina man saves little boy from rabid dog." He said, "Well, sir, I'm not from Western Carolina." He said, "Well, I can still see the banner in my newspaper. It says, it's going to say, Southern man rescues boy from rabid dog." He said, "Well, sir, I'm not a Southern man." He said, I'm from Massachusetts." And he said, "Well, I can still see the headline, Yankee murders family pet." Well, that's where Henry's from. I do want to flog a couple items from downstairs. This little DVD is called Act Like Men, Titanic Lesson in Manliness. This was a little Christian documentary that was done by some homeschool fellas that have their own little film company. They've done some really good work. And this, they took advantage of the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic and gave it a really sound Christian application, especially for young men. The examples of the men on the Titanic that gave their lives for women and children. This is really a fine video, and it's not because I'm interviewed on it. So if you do look at the back, you see that there are a number of really excellent men that were interviewed for this documentary. But I recommend it to you. And one of the young men here in our conference has put together a copy of a book that was written back in the 1830s. And it's one that I mentioned in a lecture that I gave one time. And Philip Chesser heard the lecture and heard me refer to this book that it was impossible to find, and it's been out of print for 150 years. So he went on a hunt, and he found a copy of this book, and he has reprinted it. And it's entitled The Siege of Derry. It's a historical novel, but it's in its details, it's very, very historically accurate. And it tells the story of the defense of the city of Derry, now called Londonderry, in Northern Ireland. And it's the story of a population that was mostly Presbyterian, Scots-Irish Presbyterians, who defended this city against two Roman Catholic armies and did so successfully. It's a magnificent tale, and the book is very exciting. So if you're looking for literature for your children that exalts Christ, there's biblical content all the way through this book, written by a woman who I don't know who she was, Charlotte Elizabeth. And it may have been a nom de plume. We really don't know. But it's entitled The Siege of Derry, and it's the type of heroic Christian literature that we all really enjoy. So I'll just bring that to your attention, and it's here for the first time. No, Derry, D-E-R-R-Y, Derry. Now called Londonderry, and it was called Londonderry from time to time there too. It's a walled city, and it's the only one that's never actually, the walls of Derry have never breached in the history of the city. Well, this afternoon I want to talk to you about the Scots-Irish, how they ran off the British, but they ran ahead of the church in the subsequent years. On the way to this conference, I was listening to the radio, and an ad came on the radio, and I wish I'd had a pen and pencil in my hand, or a pen or pencil in my hand, to write down the copy of this ad that came on the radio. It was great. It was an ad for a gun store, and we were going through Sevierville, Tennessee, and this gun shop is there in Sevierville. And what did he say? The ad said something to this effect. He said, "We're a family gun shop in Sevierville. We have hundreds of pistols and rifles to choose from. Come and select a weapon to protect your family." And then it said, "For those of you who take the Second Amendment to the Constitution seriously, we're your gun shop." And I can't remember the name of it. It's something like the Red, White, and Blue Gun Shop or something. But it resonated with me. In fact, in Sevierville, Sevier was one of the colonels that led the attack on Kings Mountain that I'm going to talk about. It's named after him, first governor of Tennessee. And throughout East Tennessee, and you'll see it in Western Carolina too, and Southwestern Virginia, places named after men, Scots-Irish, most of them, who fought in the Battle of Kings Mountain. And it's nice to know that some of them are still around, and they still value protecting their families. That is a characteristic of the Scots-Irish, and it's still alive and well, at least in East Tennessee, in one place. The men of 1780, the Over the Mountain Men, as they were called, were part of a surge of primarily Scots-Irish settlers who crossed the mountain layers of the Appalachians into western Virginia, the western Carolinas, down up into Kentucky and Tennessee, and west Georgia. The Over the Mountain Men were almost to a man Presbyterian, because they were Scots-Irish, of Scots-Irish heritage, at least initially. The Scots-Irish had begun immigrating into America after the early 1700s, and they started coming here in by the hundreds, and sometimes entire congregations up and moved from Northern Ireland, from the Ulster Plantation, and settled in America. Now, these people were all from Scotland originally, and the term Scots-Irish is it's a label that was invented in America. They did not call themselves that. They did not call themselves the Irish. To them, the Irish, the Roman Catholic native Irish of Ireland. They saw themselves more as Scots, and in this country, as Scots-Irish. But they had settled over the centuries in Northern Ireland under Protestant rulers and had actually thrived there. So these people were all originally, if you could do your genealogy back to Scots-Irish, eventually it would go back into Scotland, or most likely would go back into Scotland. There wasn't much intermarriage between the Scots and the Irish. But they became known as Scots-Irish because they'd lived there for generations in Ireland, and they saw themselves as sort of a unique group of people. And they were, the majority of them were Presbyterian. Even the Anglican churches of Northern Ireland were Calvinist, and a number of them became Presbyterian. And Englishmen who were members of the Anglican Church in time intermarried with the Scots and became Presbyterian as well. So it's interesting, the Reformed faith in Northern Ireland has been very strong there really since shortly after the Reformation. And these people came to America after Queen Anne, in the early 1700s, began another persecution, another demand on the nonconformist churches, the independent churches, the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Quakers, other independents or non-Anglicans were pressured to accept the Anglican bishops. And because of economic downturn and because of the opportunities that America afforded, some of these men from Northern Ireland began emigrating with their families to North America. The first pastor who came, after there were a certain number of Scots-Irish in this country, there was a demand for pastors. There were enough immigrants in America, and this is in the mid-1700s, that they needed a pastor. The first one to come was a man named Francis McKenney, who was sent from Northern Ireland. And most of the pastors had been trained in seminaries in Scotland. And thus, the population of the Scots-Irish in America grew much faster than the ability of the church to keep up with them, even in the early days. These Scots-Irish that I'm going to tell you about that moved into the mountains of the Carolinas and Virginia, over three generations from the time of the War for Independence, some of them before that, some of them a little after that, lost their allegiance to biblical Calvinism. They became Baptists and especially Methodists, and a little bit later, many of them succumbed to the blandishments of the Campbellites, the Christian Church or the Church of Christ. Presbyterianism suffered heavily in the years between the War for Independence and the middle of the 19th century on the frontier. How did the Presbyterians' failure to evangelize on the frontier and establish churches lose out to their fellow missionaries from other churches, other denominations? Is there a lesson here for us today? I want to maybe posit some suggestions about that as we go along. The early missionaries to the mountains, missionaries to the Scotch-Irish people in Virginia and in the Carolinas, typically came out of Princeton Seminary, and Princeton College, Princeton Seminary, in the early 1800s, late 1700s. Prior to that, there really was no Presbyterian seminary. There was no Reformed seminary in the United States. If you were going to have a theological training, you had to go to Yale or Harvard. And the Scotch-Irish were extremely wary of those schools. In fact, the New Englanders didn't particularly like the Scotch-Irish anyway. They were fond of saying the Scotch-Irish keep the Sabbath and everything else that isn't tied down. As they came through moving west, they took what fancied them as they went. Now, it eventually is going to be said that wherever the Scotch-Irish go, they're going to build a church, a school, and a distillery, not necessarily in that order. And the problem is they're not going to build seminaries. They're not going to train young men for the mission field and for the pastorate. Given the numbers of people of Presbyterian heritage and belief who needed ministers and who needed pastors. Well, Hezekiah Balch was the first graduate of Princeton, was the first to arrive and labor for 20 years on the Tennessee frontier. And if you study our history from that period, you'll see there are certain individual missionaries that did a great job. I'm going to need a glass of water or something up here, if someone can get one for me. But there are going to be certain ministers whose names are going to become sort of famous in Presbyterianism and are going to bring the gospel to the frontier. Thank you. Theodore Roosevelt, in his Winning of the West, wrote this about the Scotch-Irish. He said, "The Scotch-Irish, whose preachers taught the creed of Knox and Calvin, these Irish representatives of the Covenanters were in the West almost what the Puritans were in the Northeast and more than the Cavaliers were in the South. Mingled with the descendants of many other races, they nevertheless formed the kernel of the distinctively and intensely American stock who were the pioneers of our people in their march westward, the vanguard of the army of fighting settlers who with axe and rifle won their way from the Alleghenies to the Rio Grande and the Pacific. In the hard life of the frontier, they lost much of their religion, and they had but a scant opportunity to give their children the schooling in which they believed. But what few meeting houses and schoolhouses there were on the borders were theirs. The creed of the backwoodsman, who had a creed at all, was Presbyterian. That was Theodore Roosevelt's observation about the frontier. Well, the missionaries followed closely on the trail of the first settlers. As Scotch-Irish moved westward through Pennsylvania and then southward into Virginia and the Carolinas, missionaries followed them out. And it was a hazardous journey over many mountainous terrain on horseback, carrying pack saddles, little baggage, encountering hostile Indians. The Presbyterian churches on the frontier, all the men carried their rifles to church, including the pastor. And several pastors were famous Indian fighters. That actually increased the size of their congregation when they had that reputation that they could grab a rifle and go out the back door after the marauders. And there were certain pastors who did just that. And Hanover Presbytery in Virginia, which was the very first one, sent out missionaries when they could, or sponsored missionaries. And the ones from Virginia sort of laid the foundation of Presbyterianism in Kentucky, which was a little more successful initially than it was in the Carolinas and in Tennessee. Princeton eventually was the only place initially that men could be trained for the gospel ministry in Presbyterian churches. Now, eventually, Hampton-Sydney College, which will be also attached, it will be Union Seminary, is what it'll eventually be called, in Farmville, Virginia, also produced a few men. But Hampton-Sydney College, at the time of the War for Independence, or following the War for Independence, was a party school. And though it was nominally Presbyterian, and the professors were godly men, the students were not. And I'm going to say a few things about that as we go. Well, at the time of the beginning of the War for Independence, 1775, there were about 3 million Americans, and of those 3 million Americans, 900,000 or so were either Scots or Scots-Irish. There were another 600,000 Puritan English, or men of Puritan heritage, shall we say, and about 400,000 German or Dutch Reformed. And add to them Episcopalians who took the 39 Articles seriously. There is a very powerful, deep Calvinistic influence on colonial America just prior, during the Great Awakening, and then just prior to the War for Independence. Historian, one of our most famous historians of the period, George Bancroft, said this: "The Revolution of 1776, so far as it was affected by religion, was a Presbyterian measure. It was the natural outgrowth of the principles which the Presbyterianism of the old world planted in her sons. The English Puritans, the Scots Covenanters, the French Huguenots, the Dutch Calvinists, and the Presbyterians of Ulster. So intense, universal, and aggressive were the Presbyterians in their zeal for liberty that the war was spoken of in England as the Presbyterian Rebellion. An ardent colonial supporter of King George III wrote home, quote, I fix all the blame for these extraordinary proceedings upon the Presbyterians. They have been the chief and principal instruments in all these flaming measures. They are turbulent anti. They have a turbulent anti-monarchical spirit, which has always distinguished them everywhere. When the news of these extraordinary proceedings reached England, Prime Minister Horace Walpole said in Parliament, cousin America has run off with a Presbyterian parson, referring to John Witherspoon, president of Princeton and a signer of the Declaration of Independence. History is eloquent in declaring that the American Republic was born of Christianity and that Christianity was Calvinism. That's according to George Bancroft, the first great American historian of the 19th century. Some observers weren't surprised at the Scotch-Irish support of rebellion against the king. The Reverend Charles Woodmason, one of my favorites, this is a Church of England missionary on the frontier of South Carolina and North Carolina. And it's all Scotch-Irish, almost 100% wherever he goes. And he's going out there to found Anglican churches, and this is what he found instead. Not less than 20 itinerant Presbyterian, Baptist, and independent preachers are maintained by the synods of Pennsylvania and New England to traverse this country, poisoning the minds of the people, instilling democratical and commonwealth principles into their minds, embittering them against the very name of bishops and all episcopal government, and laying deep their fatal republican notions and principles, especially that they owe no subjection to Great Britain, that they are a free people, that they are to pay allegiance to King George as their sovereign, but as to Great Britain or the Parliament or any others, they have no more to think of about them as they do the Turks or the Pope. Thus do these itinerant preachers sent from the northern colonies pervert the minds of the vulgar. Amen. The Scotch-Irish weighed in on the need for asserting formal independence from Britain with petitions signed by various groups across the frontier, particularly Presbyterian churches, and particularly in North Carolina. And you're probably familiar with, and some of the communities too, of the Shenandoah Valley, certainly. But you're probably familiar with the Mecklenburg Declaration, which was drawn up near Charlotte, North Carolina, Mecklenburg County. There were six churches in the county, all of them Presbyterian, and that county drew up a Declaration of Independence a year before the Continental Congress got around to it. And in this declaration, this particular committee, I'll read you part of it just so you get the flavor of it. That all commissions, civil and military, herefore granted by the Crown to be exercised in these colonies are null and void, and the constitution of each particular colony wholly suspended. 2, that the provincial congress of each province under the direction of the Great Continental Congress is invested with all the legislative and executive powers within their respective province. So they go on and on about the covenant that they have that's been broken by the king and by parliament, so they're not a part of the empire anymore. They have seceded. And this is one secession that everybody apparently admires compared to others. The members of the Mecklenburg Committee belong to 7 congregations in the county. The chairman of the committee, Abraham Alexander, was an elder of the Sugar Creek Church. John McNitt Alexander, secretary of the committee, and Hezekiah Alexander were elders of Hopewell. Hezekiah Balch, member of the committee, was pastor of Poplar Tent. David Reese, another committeeman, was an elder from Poplar Tent. Adam Alexander and Robert Query were elders from Rocky River, and Robert Irwin was an elder from Steel Creek. So this was a year before the Declaration of Independence. Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, seceded from Britain, led by their Presbyterian elders. Complete independence, of course, secured by the Congress and a long and bitter war. The 600,000 Scots, Irish, who occupied the frontiers of the colonies were highly in favor of independence. It is agreed by a number that the soldiers of Washington's army, many of them, were from these various Scots-Irish communities. Now, just as an aside, ironically, and particularly in North Carolina, Scottish immigrants were Tories. The Scots were four square for the king and filled the Tory armies in the War for Independence. Those were the Scots. So just like in Scotland, every battle in the South is going to have Scots against Scots. Just like historically. But the one group are Scots via Ireland and are the Scots-Irish. The enthusiasm of the frontier Scots-Irish did not wane during the war, and I just want to give you one little kind of interesting example of how the people in one Presbyterian church responded to the war, and then I'm going to talk about the... eventually I'll get to the Battle of Kings Mountain here. Ladies at a Presbyterian wedding in 1778 organized a group that they called the Whig Association of the Unmarried Ladies of America. It was formed at the wedding of Miss Jenny Rowan. She was the daughter of John Rowan, who was born in Ireland about the year 1716, came to this country in his youth. He was an ardent patriot. Even before the war, he had been in trouble for attacks upon the Anglican Church in Virginia. Well, here was the announcement that was in the paper about this Presbyterian wedding. Was married last Thursday, June 11th, Mr. William Clingan, Jr. of Donegal, to Miss Jenny Roan of Londonderry, both of the county of Lancaster, a sober, sensible, agreeable young couple, and very sincere Whigs. This marriage promises as much happiness as the state of things in this our sinful world will admit. This was truly a Whig wedding, as there were present many young gentlemen and ladies, and not one of the gentlemen but had been out when called on the service of his country, and it was well known that the groom in particular had proved his heroism, as well as Whiggism, in several battles and skirmishes. After the marriage was ended, a motion was made and heartily agreed to by all present that the young unmarried ladies should form themselves into an association by the name of the Whig Association of the Unmarried Ladies of America, in which they should pledge their honor that they would never give their hand in marriage to any gentleman until he had first proved himself a patriot, in readily turning out when called to defend his country from slavery, by a spirited and brave conduct, as they would not wish to be the mothers of a race of slaves and cowards. Well, that at a Presbyterian wedding in 1778. Another historian, Froude, said this: throughout the revolted colonies, all evidence shows that the foremost, the most irreconcilable, the most determined in pushing the quarrel to the last extremity were the Scots-Irish, who the bishops and Lord Donegal and company had been pleased to drive out of Ulster. And now they were getting even. Some historians of the War for Independence claim that up to 80% of George Washington's officers were Presbyterians. And as I said, certainly Parliament thought that was the case. When Presbyterian chaplains were captured by the British, they were not exchanged like they were supposed to be. They were incarcerated. And when Presbyterian churches were come across by the British, they burnt them. And those of Reformed conviction paid a high price, for the most part, in the War for Independence. Although, admittedly, there were some who were on the side of the British. They're not the subject of our talk this morning. In 1780, the low point of the War for Independence had finally been reached by the Americans. Washington's army was just outside of Long Island. The British main army was in New York City. And the British commanders were enjoying the flesh pots of New York and didn't really want to go on campaign against Washington. They knew that eventually he'd run out of food and men. However, it was determined that some of the southern colonies were so loyalist in their sympathies that they could be brought back into union with England. And so an army was sent south to Charleston, South Carolina. Charleston was defended by an American army, and it was not well defended. And the British captured, under General Lord Cornwallis, Lord Charles Cornwallis, captured the city of Charleston, South Carolina. And it was the largest surrender of an American force, I think, up until the surrender at Fort Donelson of Confederates in the war between the states, but it was one of the largest surrenders of an American army in history, and just a handful of men escaped from that, one being Francis Marion, who was going to raise havoc against the British. That's another story. Francis Marion, by the way, Huguenot, and only one generation removed from Huguenot parents who emigrated to America. But Lord Cornwallis captured Charleston, and then he annihilated the Continental Army, the Battle of Camden. Though I'd like to tell you about that battle, there isn't time, but suffice it to say that the American regulars were defeated and wiped out. And so now, by the middle of 1780, there was no regular American army still on the ground in South Carolina. And Lord Cornwallis established his headquarters in Charlotte and began the systematic recruitment of all the Tories of the Carolinas into an army. And the man that he had to do that was very good at it. His name was Major Patrick Ferguson. Now, Patrick Ferguson is famous because he invented a sharpshooter rifle, a breech-loading rifle, and had organized a group of rangers that wore green uniforms, and they blended into the background, and they fought like Americans, and they had this breech-loading rifle that was really a good weapon. And they had, his unit had fought several times in the north, and he was a Scotsman, as were probably the finest officers in the British Army, were all the generals and the fighting men. The fighting officers were Scots, and Patrick Ferguson was one of them. And he came down to South Carolina and began recruiting loyalists into the British forces. And he created an entire loyalist army. He brought Tories with him. He brought a contingent of Tories from New York and from New Jersey, and they wore red coats. They were uniformed Tories in the traditional red coat. You know, the russet coat that was invented by Oliver Cromwell. These Tory units were wearing red coats. The recruits in the Carolinas, however, were just dressed in their normal garb of buckskins and what have you. And he trained these men to fight and use them effectively against small groups of American partisans who would not submit to the crown. It was a dim, dim time for the Americans. Well, Major Ferguson issued a message to all the American troops and all the American men of the Carolinas and Virginia on the frontier. And this message that he issued was that they needed to come down to the Low Country and either surrender their arms or join the glorious British Army in its triumph over the rebels. And if they didn't do this, he was going to bring fire and sword to their homes and to their crops. Now, he was addressing these over-the-mountain men, and he didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know who he was talking to, let me put it that way. Many of these men had been fighting Indians daily for years and years and years. These were men who lived in small communities in the Carolinas, Western Carolinas, and in Tennessee, East Tennessee, and in southwestern Virginia. In fact, where we are right now is one of the areas where there was a small group of Scotch-Irish people living. Well, these are the people that were being addressed by Major Ferguson down in South Carolina, that they needed to come in and they needed to enlist in the British Army or lay down their weapons and apologize for being rebels. Well, the over-the-mountain men, almost all of them Scotch-Irish, not totally, but most of them, Presbyterian, of course, had been sitting the war out. They hadn't been down in the Low Country fighting the British at all. The war had been going on for 5 years, and they were still busy fighting the Indians, which was part of the war, admittedly, because the British were supplying the Cherokee and the Creeks and others. They were supplying them with guns and powder and ammunition and goading them into attacking the settlements on the frontier. So these men were frontier fighters who had been busy trying to plant their crops, grow their families, fight the Indians off during the 5 years of the War for Independence. A few of them had gone down to fight. Most of them had stayed home. Well, now they get this word that the British are going to come with fire and sword to their communities. Now, if they'd have thought about it, they would have realized that the British could never get up here in one piece. Nonetheless, this was the kind of challenge that the Scotch-Irish don't let pass. It isn't the sort of thing that you throw down the gauntlet in front of these people. And so they packed their sandwiches, they got their rifles, they melted some more shot, took their gunpowder, and most of them carried hunting rifles. They're often called the Kentucky long rifle. Most of them were made in Pennsylvania, and they were works of art, and many of these men were carrying such works of art that they were going to put on display shortly. They also, every last one of them, carried tomahawks. They were frontier fighters. They fought Indians all the time. A lot of it was hand-to-hand combat with knives, axes, and tomahawks. And so they armed themselves with their normal regalia, and they began a gathering in different places. The big gathering point was down here in Abingdon, and then finally down at a place called the Cowpens in North Carolina. Now, the Cowpens is going to be another place where the British are going to get a whipping, but we don't have time for that. And that was also done, by the way, by Presbyterian Scotch-Irishmen for the most part, led by a Welsh general from Virginia. But these men gathered at Abingdon. They came from little militia groups, little towns, little villages, and singly, whole families of men gathered finally at the Cowpens down in North Carolina. The Over the Mountain men had gone to war, thanks to Major Ferguson. They met with their pastor, the Reverend Samuel Doak, D-O-A-K, who preached to them a message of encouragement and blessing. And let me tell you a little bit about this pastor. His name is very important on the frontier. Again, Theodore Roosevelt in The Winning of the West said, Reverend Doak possessed of the vigorous energy that marks the true pioneer spirit. He determined to cast in his lot with the frontier folk. He walked through Maryland and Virginia, driving before him an old flea-bitten gray horse loaded with a sack full of books, crossed the Alleghenies and came down the along Blaze Trail to the Holston settlements. That was in 1780. The hardy people among whom he took up his abode, were able to appreciate his learning and religion as much as they admired his adventurous and indomitable temper. And the stern, hard, God-fearing man became a most powerful influence for good throughout the whole formative period of the Southwest. So not only is he their first pastor in the Holston Valley, but he's going to remain there and then move into Tennessee after the war, and many hundreds of people are going to be gathered into the church as a result of Samuel Doak and his ministry. A remarkable man. In fact, he himself had been converted under the preaching of, one historian says, he was converted under the preaching of some guy named Alexander, Archibald Alexander. And he was trained in Lexington, Virginia. He was a graduate of Princeton, 1775. And he himself was involved in fighting off Indian raiding parties even while he was moving south into the settlements. Bishop E.E. Hoss said this of him, "He feared God so much that he feared nothing else and would have made a fit chaplain for a regiment of Cromwell's Ironsides." So you get a picture of Samuel Doak, this Presbyterian pastor's tall, muscular, stern, grave appearance, and good common sense, which is what was appreciated in the frontier communities. Well, the troops traveled by day up and down the Corduroy Mountains and through the gaps to assemble at the Cowpens. When they got there, they were able to assemble about 900 men who were fit to continue the journey to track down Major Ferguson, whom they found out was sitting atop King's Mountain. It's just right on the border south of Charlotte between the Carolinas. And there, the Over the Mountain men came to punish Major Ferguson for his indiscretions. The Tories put sprigs of green in their coats so they could identify each other in the battle, and the Patriots took white pieces of paper and stuck those in their coats so that they could identify each other, because once the battle started, you didn't know who was on whose side, unless somebody was wearing a red coat, which some of them were. And much to their hurt, I might say, it was one of those really bad ideas whose time had come. The riflemen had the advantage of being able to kill their enemy at a much longer distance. Now, fighting on King's Mountain, that's not going to necessarily be a great advantage because it's heavily wooded. The Tory troops, and by the way, there's only one British soldier in the Battle of King's Mountain. That's Major Ferguson. He's the only British soldier there. All the rest are Americans. And it's the Tories are carrying muskets for the most part. Now, there are a few riflemen. They have a few riflemen, but most of them are carrying muskets. The advantage of a musket is that you can load and fire three times a minute. The disadvantage is you can't hit anything. And so while the riflemen are going to be attacking, they can only fire one shot a minute. The advantage is they never miss. Now, the British, when they fight a battle, the key to victory is closing with the enemy and finishing the battle using the bayonet. They were the best bayonet troops in Europe, and they had gone from victory to victory down through the years, and they were going to continue to do so against Napoleon. Once the British infantry closed with an enemy, that bayonet just became the most deadly thing in the world. Well, you can't put a bayonet on a Kentucky rifle. And they're also fragile things. You can't be whacking people over the head with a Kentucky rifle because it breaks. And the riflemen would be at a disadvantage if the British soldiers could get close enough to use the bayonet, which they do in the Battle of Kings Mountain, in which case out come the tomahawks and the knives, and then it becomes a real mess. Well, that is what is in front of these men. They're led by six men who call themselves colonel. And each colonel has brought his own following. And those 900 men will only follow their own colonel. They won't listen to anybody else, A. And B, the reality is there are 900 colonels that are going to attack this mountain. The men fill their mouths with five musket balls. That does two things. It slakes the thirst in the middle of battle. You're chewing on lead. And also, you don't have to be fumbling around for your next shot. You spit it out and put it in your barrel. And so the Americans, the colonels gathered together outside of Kings Mountain, and they had their big discussion of strategy. And the strategy was really complicated. Charge and yell like demons. So that was the strategy. They surrounded the mountain so that nobody was going to be able to leave in one piece. And so the attack began with basically six columns of over-the-mountain men, angry, defending their homes and used to fighting Indians. And so they had what they called, and one of their most effective weapons, the Indian war whoop. And so they gave them the Indian war whoop and began swarming up the hill. They were led by men like Colonel Benjamin Cleveland. Probably not a Presbyterian, well, at least not known as being a Christian man. He specialized in hanging Tories. That's what he did for a living. He searched them out and had them hanged. And after the war, he became a judge in South Carolina, and he continued that as a judge after independence. He was a very large man who loved to eat. He died of a heart attack at his breakfast table, tucking in with both hands. Anyway, he's the guy who was leading one of the columns up the hill, and of course, Colonel William Campbell, Colonel James Williams, all Scots-Irish men. And they knew what they were fighting for. John Sevier himself had 15 children. Isaac Shelby had 10 children. The Scotch-Irish were the most productive race of people on earth. And they technically still are, although they've apparently forgotten about it, because they're not even reproducing their own population in Scotland today. Scotland's populated today by Eastern Europeans. But maybe it's because all the good ones came to America to fight at King's Mountain. Anyway, these guys had large families. They knew exactly what they were fighting for, and some were going to go on to great fame after this battle. Isaac Shelby will become the first governor of North Carolina. He's going to lead troops in the War of 1812 in a great American victory at the Battle of the Thames in Canada. So he's an old warrior that stays that way. Well, they took their rifles, and they went up against the British soldiers. Some of the surviving Tories wrote that they'd never seen men who looked like this. They were tall, they were lean, they had long hair, they were filthy, they were screaming all the time like Indians, and they carried tomahawks. This was not what they signed up to face. They had never seen anything like it. Just to give you a flavor of the nature of these men in this battle, we know a lot. We know the name of every single soldier that fought at King's Mountain, first of all, on both sides. And one of the Patriot soldiers, a surprising number of them were 16 years old, and there were a couple that were 15 and 14. I mean, these were men. They didn't invent teenagers till the 1950s. And in those days, when you turned 12, you were working side by side with your father, and you were a man. By the time you were 14, you were a big man. So there are a lot of young men in the American Army. And one, Robert Henry, age 16, was standing behind a tree, and he turned and fired, and he went to reload, and a red coat was on him with a bayonet. And just as the guy thrust his bayonet at him, someone shot the Tory and killed him, but the bayonet ran through Henry's hand and pinned his hand to his leg and went all the way through his leg. And so he was laying on the ground pinned by this rifle right next to the dead Tory. One of the other men coming up looked down and saw what was happening, and usually they didn't stop to help anybody, but in this case, the guy saw he was only 16 years old, a young man, and so he reached down and he pulled the bayonet out of his leg and then kicked it free from his hand. And Henry wrapped his hand up, and when the battle was over, he went to his home, to his mother, who patched him up, and then he fought through the rest of the war, just like a lot of these men did. And he lived until 1863. He was the last, probably the last Kings Mountain man. He served in the House of Commons in North Carolina. And he was one of six Henrys that were at Kings Mountain. And you can go on and on with the stories of the men of Kings Mountain, but the end of the story is that the Tories finally were pushed to the top of the mountain, and they made their last stand. Patrick Ferguson was on his horse, blowing his silver whistle, calling his men to him. He was a fine officer, deserving of a better cause. And once the American marksmen saw him, apparently quite a number of them decided that they wanted him as their trophy. And he was hit about 15 times simultaneously. And he was very seriously killed. So, with the death of Major Ferguson, the second in command started waving the white flag, and some of the prisoners were shot when they were trying to surrender. But the officers were able actually to get them to stop fighting somehow, and put an end to the slaughter. In the end, about 30 Americans have been, 30 Patriots have been killed, about 60 wounded, and the Tories lost 225 killed, 200 wounded, and 800 captured. And then they took the captured ones off to prisons further up in the mountains. Well, such was the end of the Battle of Kings Mountain, and within 2 years, officially, the war came to an end. The Battle of Kings Mountain was the most thorough American victory of the war. The enemy took 100% casualties, and it stunned Lord Cornwallis and cost him at least a fifth of his troops. Now, the two armies would go on to fight at the Cowpens and at in northern North Carolina. And eventually Cornwallis had to make his way to Yorktown to refit. He was so battered by these guys that he took his army off to Yorktown, Virginia. And we know how Washington slipped away from New York and went down and trapped Cornwallis at Yorktown and put an effective end to the war. There was still fighting until 1783, and there was fighting in South Carolina, although the British retreated back to Charleston and didn't come out for a year. Because it was too dangerous, and the war was winding down. So by 1783, the war had come to an end, and all those Scotch-Irish were still up there in the mountains. And not only that, thousands more were heading west now that America had won its independence. The Presbyterian Church realized they needed to get ministers up into the mountains and get them there quickly, because these Northern Ireland pioneers were moving, and they were moving west into Tennessee, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Western Virginia, down into the Mississippi Valley. And somehow or other, the church had to keep up with them. They were outrunning the church. It was not an easy task. As one historian has said, many of the immigrants, it is true, had come to Kentucky with their Bibles and catechisms and with an earnest desire for the ordinances of religion. But the religious and moral life of America was at its lowest ebb after the Revolutionary War. A great many of the early settlers had lived for years upon the borders of civilization, exposed to the demoralizing influences of the frontier, without Sabbaths or ministers or churches. Still others suffered from the blight of French infidelity, which spread rapidly through the country after the Revolution. Conditions in Kentucky were not favorable for the spread of the gospel. And one of the pastors who did go there, David Rice, said this: "After I had been there some weeks and had preached several places, I found scarcely one man and but few women who supported a credible profession of religion. Some were grossly ignorant of the first principles of religion. Some were given to quarreling and fighting, some to profane swearing, some to intemperance, perhaps most of them totally negligent of the forms of religion in their own houses. I could not think a church formed of such materials as these could properly be called a church of Christ." Well, for a whole year, Father Rice, as he became known as, preached without administering the sacraments. But over the next 2 years after that, he organized three congregations. That was in Kentucky. And built churches in each place, and even started a school, which eventually became Transylvania University. The ministers had to not just preach to their congregations, but they had to teach them how to read and write. And eventually they founded schools all over the place. Yet the fact remained that they needed pastors, they needed ministers. And the only place to get them was Princeton. And Princeton was putting them out as fast as they could, and they had a missionary spirit in Princeton. And most of these men on the frontier, that's where they were from. It was the only place that was truly putting out Reformed men into the ministry. And most of them went into the North and went into the Northwest. So as the population moved westward through Pennsylvania and into Ohio, a lot of the missionaries came with them. If you look at Ohio and you just pinpoint the Presbyterian colleges in Ohio, you can see the migration route of the Scots-Irish. There's one college after another all the way across Ohio. I went to one of them in western Ohio. And all the way through Indiana and Illinois, the same story. So a lot of the men coming out of Princeton, New Jersey, stayed in the north. The south was too warm. It was known for disease, and it was known for Indians. And in the frontier people were really rough. And so it wasn't an attractive thing to all of the men who were coming out of Princeton seeking churches on the frontier. But some of them did, and fairly successfully. Baptists and Presbyterians had about this time an equal number of churches in Kentucky. This is about 1790, 16 each. But the Baptist churches, with no educational qualifications for their ministers, had 30 preachers, while the Presbyterians, with high educational standards, had only 7. The Methodists, meanwhile, with only 2 preachers, were organizing their first Kentucky circuit. I'm going to say a few things about those Methodists in a little bit. But this is one of the, this is a criticism of Presbyterians, and it ought not to be. But the practical part of the matter is that Presbyterians insisted on their pastors being able to read and understand the scriptures. Fancy that. And they had to be able to understand the Bible in the original languages. They had to learn Greek and Hebrew so they could rightly divide the word of truth. And so Presbyterians, historically and in this period in particular, did have high standards for their for their ministers that they were training at Princeton and later at Ham Sydney. The Baptists, however, they only had to feel the call. They feel the call, they're qualified to be a minister, and off they would go. And they would organize groups of people who had become Christians or people who wanted to be involved in the church. And so they had ministers all over the place, men with no theological training. All they had was their Bible. So that's enough. We don't need anything more than that. And they began preaching and gathering people all across the South, in Kentucky and Tennessee, the Mountains, the Carolinas, the Baptists did. And began organizing churches left and right. And it wasn't long before the Scotch-Irish Presbyterian communities disappeared as Presbyterians, and they became Baptists. And then the Methodists are going to come along and reap a huge, huge harvest. And one of the great appeals of those two particular denominations, and I will say this for the Baptists on the frontier, most of them were regular Baptists. That means they were Calvinists. So many of them were Calvinists in their when it came to the doctrines of grace, but their great appeal was that they were independent, that they were self-sufficient, that they were like the men of the frontier who didn't want to be under anybody's authority but their own. And so that kind of church polity appealed to them, being independent, being the sovereign individuals that they were. They conquered the frontier, and the Baptist polity appealed to that. They liked that, not having anybody else connected. Presbyterians, as you know, would seek to organize a presbytery and ordain elders and sort of follow what I would consider the biblical model of the church, while these wildcat churches were just springing up all around them. And that's one of the problems the Presbyterians faced, as they were so outnumbered by these other men, some of whom were brave men, good and true, and godly men to boot, but uneducated and particularly appealing to that independent, sovereign man spirit of the frontier. So it was not an easy task. And they, among Presbyterians, the tendency was to go into the Northwest. Well, a great revival of biblical Christianity broke out at Hampton Sydney in Farmville, Virginia, in the 1790s, and almost the whole student body was converted. It was a careless group of reprobates, and the president of the college, Francis Blair Smith, was preaching the gospel, and a couple students were converted. And pretty soon they started prayer groups and Bible studies. And before you know it, Hampton Sydney had become a bastion of believing young Christian men, many of whom then determined to go into the ministry. And so the South now had a Presbyterian seminary to direct pastors into the frontier. The Synod of the Carolinas was organized in 1788, and they were able to, you know, just put a handful of missionaries into the frontier. For some years, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church in the country tended to send their men into Pennsylvania and Ohio and Indiana. And so the South was neglected to some extent. From the want of preachers of their own Presbyterian denomination, says one historian, South Carolina historian, the descendants of the old stock are falling in either with the Baptists or the Methodists according to the neighborhood in which they live. Here's another quote regarding one of the churches. This church, the first of any denomination in Richland County, had occasional preaching but became extinct as a Presbyterian church, and the neighborhood became the seat of a Methodist church and congregation because no minister could be supplied to the work. One Presbyterian missionary wrote back this: "We almost despair of being able to do anything efficiently in the domestic department of our society unless missionaries can be raised up at home. We have too long looked to the north for a supply. The many vacancies that that there occur, and the vast openings in the West are more than sufficient to employ all the ministers that can be educated at the North for more than 100 years to come. And there seems to be little in the South inviting to our Northern brethren. They dread our climate. Our summers are considered fatal to strangers. And they, in general, exceedingly dislike the domestic circumstances of our country, by which they mean slavery. And so even by 1800, the early 1800s, Northern Presbyterians are wary of coming south because they don't like the institution of slavery and what that implied to them. Columbia Seminary was founded in 1828 in South Carolina, but by then it was too late to capture most of the churches on the frontier. But something did happen in 1800. Remarkable thing, and that was the Second Great Awakening began, as it were. Now, there are different historians think that the Second Great Awakening started in different places, but a number of revivals, you might say, broke out on the frontier. And I'm just going to say a few summary comments about that and recommend to you the book Revival and Revivalism by Ian Murray. If you haven't read it, you ought to. It will give you some insight into the spread of the gospel and the nature of the change of the gospel in these frontier communities as revivalism came to be the pattern. Well, as these revivals of what they would call in those days vital religion broke out across the frontier, the preachers who were preaching at these convocations with thousands of people were mostly Presbyterians. But they were not the ones that reaped the harvest in the end. For as these great revivals occurred, the Baptists and Methodists hurried over to the areas where the revivals were taking place and began organizing churches. And in the end, they certainly got the majority of them. Let me just draw a couple quick conclusions, and I was prepared to talk a lot about the revivals on the frontier, but let me just make some summary comments, some application here. One of the problems among Presbyterians that occurred following the Revolutionary War, I alluded to earlier when I said that, or when I read that French Enlightenment thinking had become prominent in America. Listen, in 1796, Joseph Caldwell wrote this about the University of North Carolina. And this gives us maybe an insight into that intellectual ferment following the War for Independence. The state appears to be swarming with lawyers. It is almost the only profession for which parents educate their children. Religion is so little in vogue and in such a state of depression that affords no prospects sufficient to tempt people to undertake its cause. In New Jersey, it has the public respect and support. But in North Carolina, and particularly in that part of the state which lies east of us, everyone believes that the first step which he ought to take to rise into respectability is to disavow, as often and as publicly as he can, all regard for the leading doctrines of the Scriptures. They are bugbears very well fitted to scare the ignorant and weak into obedience to the law. But the laws of morality and honor are sufficient to regulate the conduct of men of letters and cultivated reasons. One of the principal reasons why religion is so slighted and almost scouted is that it is taught only by Methodists and ranters, with whom it seems to consist only in the power of their throats or wildness and madness of their gesticulations and distortions. So, where were the Presbyterians? They were there. And one of the things I would like to suggest is a reason why the Reformed faith did not keep up with the Scotch-Irish immigration was that the War for American Independence was a great dislocator of people. And among men who respected education, like Presbyterians do, the colleges and universities already were beginning to teach the doctrines derived from the French thinking and revolutionary thinking and humanistic thinking, from the Scottish, so-called Scottish Enlightenment, to the English Enlightenment, to the French philosophes. And this is a telling comment by a Christian man looking, just in this case, at the University of North Carolina. So one problem is with Christian parents. It's obvious that they were not training the next generation at home. That the Presbyterians, who could most be expected to be confessional men and catechism men and training their children to understand the faith and to live it out and pressing them to consider the gospel ministry, it wasn't happening. And it may be because so many were killed or in the war. It may be because the churches were so scattered and beaten down from the war for independence. There may be all kinds of reasons, but a generation got missed. That generation that fought the war and immediately following, through the 1780s, in the first part of the 1790s, the Reformed Church was AWOL in terms of the families. Now, they were still trying to train men for the ministry, you know, at Princeton, and there were still some devout men who were heading out as missionaries trying to catch up to the immigration. But that generation, that generation of the so-called revolution, seems to me was almost lost until great revivals of religion came. And that included in the Reformed churches. In fact, it was Reformed preachers through whom the Holy Spirit worked to begin this massive calling to repentance of men, especially in the frontier areas. And then a second thing. So the first thing I would say is a generation got lost, and it's because the parents didn't pass on the faith. I mean, and they didn't press their sons to consider gospel ministry. And that's a problem that I see today among Reformed Christians. They just wait for things to happen. And churches don't seriously identify men that young men who may really have the gifts of the ministry and press them to follow that. Now, I know in God's providence, He brings to the ministry those whom He will. Nonetheless, we have responsibilities to our children to train them in the faith. And I think that we find a generation here that failed to do that. They were so busy building their cabins and fighting their Indians and conducting warfare, and there were no ministers there. The first thing that goes, by the way, is the Sabbath. Notice that one quote was, "No Sabbaths, no ministers, no sacraments, no means of grace." And thus the frontier became what it became. And then along came the Methodists and the Baptists. The Methodists, it was the same thing. You just had to feel the call. And if you did, they gave you a horse and a Bible and saddlebags and tracks, and you began a circuit. And the Methodists were hardy folks. They set up preaching stations all over Tennessee and Kentucky and Ohio, and they just made the circuit. So everybody had a minister. You know, they know every fourth week we're going to have preaching. And they connected all these, led by Francis Asbury, the great bishop of Kentucky. The Methodists, in the end, by 1840, by the time the churches split over slavery, the Southern Baptists and the Southern Methodists split over slavery in 1844, the Methodists are the largest denomination in the United States by far. And they took advantage of these great revivals, and they gathered the people into churches with circuit riders who were strong individual men who had sometimes were Arminians in their theology and really appealed to the frontier mentality. And I'll tell you what, the Presbyterians who did go westward into the frontier, the men who did go did a good job, but there weren't very many of them. There weren't nearly enough of them. And I think we face the same problems today. And the answer is not, we don't need to require education. You know, we don't need to make them learn Greek and Hebrew. That's not the answer to the problem. We need to encourage young men who have gifts to pursue the ministry. And we need to support them as much as we can. Now, we're not necessarily in a frontier situation, but in some ways we are, because we're in a pagan society. And we are on the frontier as Reformed people. This is interesting. About this time, Augustus Toplady wrote a hymn, and he wrote it in part as an argument against the Methodists. Now, they've adopted this hymn, and they love it, but it was designed against them. And it's Rock of Ages. Should my tears forever flow, should my zeal no respite know, all for sin could not atone, thou must save and thou alone. In my hand no price I bring, simply to thy cross I cling. That was a Reformed hymn, and it was written against the Methodists, who denied all the doctrines in that hymn. Yet they embraced it, and that's one of their favorites still today. But the circuit riders certainly were successful. Well, I think family breakdown and the outrunning of the ministers in preparation, the church just never really caught up like it should. That's not to say that Presbyterianism and the Reformed Church lost out. They didn't lose out altogether, not by a long shot. In fact, in the Confederate Army and in the war between the states, the Presbyterians had the largest number of chaplains. They way outstripped all the other denominations. But maybe it was because they got to fight. Whatever reason. Well, I'm going to stop there, and I know some of you have questions. I'd be happy to entertain them, but the afternoon is waning, and I've overspent my time. There are other things to say about the Second Great Awakening and its effect on Presbyterianism on the frontier, but I think that'll at least give you an idea of what happened after the War for Independence, when the Scots-Irish outran the church. Thank you.